First of all, thank you very much, Brianne, for inviting me to speak, and thanks to the Occupy Chicago Education Committee for accepting the proposal. As I mentioned to some folks I was talking to earlier, my background is actually not in urban planning and design, so I come to this as like a pure interest, something that just kind of popped up as I was doing other things. My main research area is in literary history, so I do work in Gilded Age American history. And as I was doing work on regionalist fiction, I just increasingly became interested in this question of how does space influence culture? How does it create certain types of culture and then dissuade people from creating other kinds? So I've done a lot of reading specifically of David Harvey and Henri Lefebvre, who was an influence to David Harvey's work. I'm going to be speaking mostly about Lefebvre's work today. Two works in particular, one, The Production of Space, and then the other one being his book, The Right to the City, which came out right around the same time. As Brianne mentioned, I'm going to try to keep this relatively short to about 20 minutes or so we have time for some discussion. And I will begin without further ado. So what does it mean to occupy a public space, or how Chicago's design frustrates participatory democracy? I'd like to begin my talk today with a quote. Social relations, which are concrete abstractions, have no real existence save in and through space. Their underpinning is spatial. In each particular case, the connection between this underpinning and the relations it supports calls for analysis. Such an analysis must imply and explain a genesis and constitute a critique of those institutions that have transformed the space under consideration. This passage comes from The Production of Space, which represented the culmination of French philosopher and sociologist Henri Lefebvre's thoughts on the relationship between people, environment, and ideology. Lefebvre argues throughout his book for a process he refers to as transduction. Using transduction, the analyst of space, and most often that space is the city in Lefebvre's writings, would turn to the physical world as if to a text. Reading the physical world would then yield lessons about the structures of power as they exist in a given place and time, as well as reveal fissures or cracks within the dominant ideology, which could then be exploited to initiate change. That change would be led, Lefebvre argued consistently, by ordinary inhabitants of the city, who in the process of using its spaces in ways that met their needs, rather than those of urban planners and businesses, would reclaim the right to the city. Lefebvre's call for a right to the city, or droit à la vie, held as its central premise the belief that cities were not products or objects, but were composed of a series of processes. The ideal city was always dynamic, a work, or as Lefebvre called it, an oeuvre. It never really existed, but was always in the process of being made by its inhabitants. Now, Lefebvre readily acknowledged that in his extensive body of writing on cities that such an ideal city did not yet exist, but its ethos could be found in specific locations within our existing urban landscape. One such location was that of the social or public space. There are nearly as many ways of defining public space as there are types of public space. From a purely legal perspective, the public space can be understood as real estate that is owned by the citizens of a city or a town. Public spaces are paid for and maintained using our tax dollars. In its collective ownership, the urban public space thus bears within it the status of the commons, a trope more often associated with rural life than with that of the city. But moving beyond the question of ownership to that of use, public space is unique within the urban plan and that it remains a locus of spontaneity, not as heavily zoned as the business or residential districts of the urban environment. Public spaces are, at least in theory, open to a multiplicity of uses. The limit to these uses is typically defined by the type of urban space under consideration, such as a park, plaza, boulevard, walkway, etc., and also by its location. Considering for a moment a sidewalk. A sidewalk is a public space, but its size and placement dictates that motion is encouraged rather than stasis. The same is true of the median in a boulevard, although there the flow of traffic determines when and how a person may move. Parks and plazas provide more options for use, but when such sites are high visibility or are close to centers of power, both political and economic, they are commonly subject to strict regulation. Consequently, these public spaces present to the user a mixed message. You're open to experience this land as you will, but in doing so, you become subject to surveillance and perhaps arrest. Now, Chicago possesses a wide variety of public spaces. Most of them in or near the Loop, the city's urban core. Today, I'd like to focus specifically on four that are of immediate relevance to the Occupy Chicago movement. These four are Grant Park, Federal Plaza, the sidewalk on LaSalle near Jackson, and Daley Plaza. Through examining the origin of these spaces, their design, and what that design signifies for the everyday user, I hope to spark a fruitful discussion here today about the structural obstacles presented in Chicago for the supporter of participatory democracy, and more importantly, how those obstacles might be overcome as the Occupy movement enters its crucial third month of existence. The first of these public spaces, Grant Park, is also the oldest, as it has existed in some form since the city was incorporated in 1837. Originally known as Lake Park, the area along the lakefront was in the city's early years largely commercial in nature. This was the age of water transport. That was when it was truly the city's front door. With Michigan Avenue marking the natural shoreline of the city, a small strip of land between Michigan Avenue and the Illinois Central Railroad tracks was all the city had at that time to claim as its front yard. It was not until 1890 when landfill thrown into the lake, some of it from the Great Chicago Fire, had expanded the park east of the railroad tracks, that attention was drawn towards the poor conditions in Lake Park. Aaron Montgomery Ward, owner of the Montgomery Ward department store chain, who vied with Sears Roebuck and Company for the patronage of the middle-class consumer, sued the city of Chicago. Ward demanded the city clean up Lake Park and make the space available for public recreational use. Initially, the city demurred and began plans to develop the park for commercial use, a process which began with the construction of what is now the Art Institute of Chicago's main building, the Allerton Hall. Ward again sued the city in 1896, and this time the South Park Commission was created to manage the space under the new name of Grant Park. They hired the Olmsted Brothers firm, famous for their work in New York City, to create parkland on our lakefront, similar in design to that found in France. And at the same time, this began a process of arguing for philanthropic business as well. So that's right around the time you start to see businessmen's names going on things. And it's no accident this is happening after several major, major, major labor strikes in the city of Chicago. And also the building of Fort Sheridan, which you may or may not know, was designed specifically because the army was called here so often. They figured they might as well just have a permanent base here the next time a strike broke out. So, the basic design structure created by the Olmsted firm can still be seen in the park today. An aerial view of Grant Park shows the Buckingham Fountain, which was added in 1927, at the center of Grant Park, with the Grand Boulevard entry of Congress Parkway leading straight to the fountain, and behind it Queens Landing and Lake Michigan. To either side of the fountain are a series of squares crisscrossed by walking paths, which divide the park into zones or regions. To the northern end of the park near Monroe Street are the Petrillo Bandshell and an open field designated for musical events and festivals. The southern end contains open fields whose use is primarily that of summer sports, such as softball or tennis. The park is further subdivided by multiple roads. To the east, Lakeshore Drive cuts off Grant Park from the waterfront, where a small strip of parkland lies adjacent to the seawall. On the western edge of the park, Columbus Drive and the Illinois Central Railroad tracks divide the eastern portion of the park, built on landfill, from its point of origin. All that remains, in fact, of the original Lake Park is a tiny strip of trees and grass that begins at the edge of the Art Institute's southern boundary and extends south along Michigan Avenue to Magdalena Abkanovitz's sculpture garden, Agora, right at Roosevelt in Michigan. In attempting to add classical grandeur to what was perceived by many outsiders as a gritty industrial city, Chicago's urban planners created what's best considered a pleasure grid to mimic that of the city street system. Residents would be welcome to enjoy this space along the lakefront, the city's now beautified front yard, but would only be allowed to use that space in certain ways. It was also understood from the very beginning that Grant Park was as much a showcase of the city to outsiders as it was a locus of leisure for its urban residents. Tourists would see Grant Park in its neoclassical grandeur and realize that Chicago was not a cultureless city, but rather the jewel of the Midwest. This meaning adheres to the park to the present day, even though the city has long since turned its commerce and primary modes of transportation away from the water, making the lakefront, I suppose, our side door rather than the front door. It nonetheless insists that Grant Park be viewed as the main entrance to Chicago. Since adding Millennium Park to the lakefront park system, a space that is a testament not simply to our former mayor's ego, but also to the power of neoliberalism in Chicago in the guise of what we like to call here the public-private partnership, quote, the symbolic function of Grant Park has only been underscored. On the surface, consequently, a space crafted for the people instead is best understood as a playground for tourists, a revenue generator for a cash-strapped city. Now, as we move west away from Grant Park, we soon pass through the city's skywall and into the canyon-like streets of the Loop. As we move into the Loop, located at Adams and Dearborn Street, is the next public space I'd like to consider. A small, windswept plot of stone, steel, and concrete known as the Federal Plaza. Completed in 1974, this grim and tiny space is home to a sculpture, Alexander Calder's Flamingo, and a farmer's market. With only a small plot of trees and shrubs near its northeast corner, Federal Plaza attempts to create the illusion of openness in the otherwise claustrophobic confines of the federal government complex. This openness, however, is mocked by the modernist high-rises designed by Mies van der Rohe that overlook the plaza. The Kleczynski Federal Building and the Dirksen Federal Courthouse across the street not only block natural light from entering Federal Plaza, but also foster a sense of paranoia in the person brave enough to stand for any length of time in this public space. And when I was trying to think of a way of classifying, I thought of symmetrical paranoia, right? Wow. Seemed like the best way of describing it, because it's perfectly symmetrical and yet causes that reaction. Each building is made of black glass and steel that reflects back the viewer's gaze and illustrates the truism that federal government is not open, as the plaza asserts, but rather closed to the gaze of the ordinary inhabitant. All that moderates this inhospitable space is the presence of the lowly post office, another laughable tribute to the access Federal Plaza appears to provide, but ultimately makes impossible to utilize. Taken together, the elements of design in this plaza clearly indicate the pedestrian might pause for a moment to regard the view, but must certainly move on, lest their presence disturb the paranoid symmetry of the modernist plaza and wake the sleeping machine of federal power. Now, God, we wouldn't want that to happen, would we? Due west of the Federal Plaza is a site that many of my audience today knows quite well, and that is the sidewalk located across from the Board of Trade, next to the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago. Now here I must pause in my journey of spatial analysis for just a moment to comment on how astute Occupy Chicago's early organizers were in their choice of site. For at this intersection is situated the true heart of power in the city, the central bank and the commodity exchange. It's also where our current problems began, as the credit default swap was invented at the Board of Options Exchange. Yet as we might expect, this nexus of power does not advertise itself as such. The Loop's canyon here is at its narrowest and most stark, with the building severely close to the sidewalk. There are few places to pause individually to admire the scenery, let alone gather together a group of people. One of the few open spaces in the area is a privately owned courtyard that leads back from the Jackson Street entrance of the Board of Trade building to the Chicago Board Options Exchange, the Chicago Stock Market, and the LaSalle Street Metro Station behind it. Consequently, the motionless spectator or would-be protester is forced to choose between moving close to the buildings and risking a charge of trespass, or shifting out towards the street and colliding with passerby. The sidewalk thus represents a tightrope that the inhabitant of the city, dwarfed by their surroundings, must navigate with care. At night, the threat of collision with other pedestrians fades, but the quandary of balance still remains, as police may arrest those they perceive to be, quote, in the public way. Forced by our metaphorical policeman to move on from Jackson and LaSalle, a street that is literally obstructed by Capitol, I might add, as the Chicago Board of Trade sits on top of it, we now move north on LaSalle Street to Chicago's City Hall. Bearing a strong resemblance to Union Station, Chicago's City Hall suggests permanence. We are here and we are not going anywhere. Its exterior also baffles public access. One must search the exterior walls of the building carefully for points of entry. Were it not for the Daily Plaza on the Clark Street side of the building, one might be forgiven for assuming that our City Hall doesn't even have a front door. While the City Hall was completed in 1911, Daily Plaza on its eastern side is of a more recent vintage, finished in 1965. When Richard J. Daley, or King Richard I, as I like to refer to him, died in office in 1976, the plaza was named in his honor. This municipal plaza receives more natural light than the Federal Plaza to the south. It also has more greenery, as planter boxes of trees and shrubs are located on both the east and west sides of the plaza. Towards the center is a sculpture known simply as the Picasso. Added in 1967, its subject matter and status as art have long been a question of dispute in the city. Perhaps Chicago journalist Mike Royko put it best when he referred to the statue as a symbol of the "I will get you before you get me" spirit, sort of the inner animal inside of us as Chicagoans. And he said here Picasso had apparently been truer to Chicago's life and essence than he knew. On the southwest corner of the plaza is a fountain close to the trees, and to the northeast is a flame commemorating Chicago area veterans, specifically of the Vietnam War. In an attempt to encourage visitors to stay in this relatively open location and treat it as a public space rather than simply a shortcut, events are frequently scheduled at the Daily Plaza. Santa's house is already up, you'll be happy to know, next to the city's Christmas tree, and the annual holiday market will soon open. During the warmer months, metal tables and chairs are placed in the plaza, and a farmer's market appears on Thursdays. Yet in spite of these attempts to be welcoming, the plaza remains somehow inhospitable and sends conflicting messages to those pausing to sit inside it. Several semesters ago, one of my students was conducting ethnographic research on Chicago's City Hall. I teach a course in research paper writing here at Columbia College, and I like them to actually get out in the city, explore it, and write about it. And he wanted to write about Chicago's City Hall. While sitting in the hallway of the building itself, he was arrested by the Cook County Sheriff's Police. Later released with no charges filed against him, they did threaten to arrest him for loitering. He then crossed the street to observe City Hall via the plaza. This time, sitting on one of the metal chairs provided, he noticed a lone figure circling the plaza out of the corner of his eye. That figure turned out to be a security guard who approached him and asked him, quote, if he needed any help. Saying no, the security guard moved on and continued his circle around the plaza's perimeter. Not arrested this time, he instead found himself vigorously surveilled. Here in the plaza, it would seem, the mayor is content to allow his peasants to play. But in this space devoted to a dead king, all eyes are turned to the potentially threatening inhabitant, lest a group form and things get out of hand. Ending our tour of four public spaces at this site, it's worth pausing to consider what we've learned about Chicago from a careful study of their design. First, let's consider again what each site represents. Grant Park is the center of tourism of Chicago, the face the city shows off to the world. Federal Plaza is a dot on the map, suggesting both the inaccessibility of national government to the local resident and its small footprint in Chicago's iconography of power. The lack of extensive public space on Jackson and LaSalle highlights the ability of financial power to mask its true influence on city life. A blank wall and a wall of humanity encourage motion rather than observation and contemplation. Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. And finally, Daley Plaza advertises itself not only as a public space, but also as the true seat of power in the Windy City. All blessings flow from the mayor who gives his loyal subjects a space to play under his protective gaze. And yet, like any father, this one can grow stern at a moment's notice, chastising his unruly children for their foolish whining. As different as the meanings of each space are, they nonetheless present the same basic message to the resident of the city. You should keep moving. Power understands that motion discourages thought at the same time that it promotes commerce. Motion also, usefully enough, fosters self-absorption. One is intent to get where they are going without delay, and the city's grid is more than happy to oblige. Bounded by this economic geography, residents of Chicago become not only carriers of cargo, but actual cargo themselves. Freight to be moved from point A to point B. This depressing insight leads me to the heart of the matter. This is where I get to the solutions portion and away from the problem. My answer to the question that serves as the title of this talk: what does it mean to occupy a public space? Since none of the four spaces examined fit Lefebvre's model of a public space, any activity that goes against the norm in these locations violates the stated design intentions of the technocrats who manage the city. These actions could potentially be viewed as transgressive acts. A great example of that is if you're in the park after 11 o'clock, right, for whatever the purpose, you can get arrested, even if you're just enjoying the view. But is transgression of the rules of public space the same thing as occupation? My answer to you today would be yes and no. Transgression is a tactical move, what Michel de Certeau, the French ethnologist, referred to as making do. In describing how this process operates in urban space, de Certeau uses the example of jaywalking, or taking shortcuts, which operates in a way he describes as a pedestrian speech act. We violate the grid by cutting across it at an angle. Our act is small, an individual statement. Its legacy, however, might take on greater import. An example of this can be found on the UIC campus, another great example of paranoid symmetry. When the walkways were redesigned, no straight path was created between University Hall, the main campus offices, and the library. Thus, you could see the library a few hundred feet away, but could not walk to it directly without cutting across the grass. Hundreds of faculty, staff, and students did just that. Soon there was a permanent dead spot in the grass leading in a straight line to the Daley Library. And guess what? Not long after that, a walkway was laid in that direction. A shortcut had metamorphosed from an individual decision into a group statement. Space was reclaimed from the designer by those who used it every day. Now, this act of reclamation, small though it is at the heart of what it means, at least in my view, to demand the right to the city. But it is simply a beginning. As soon as these would-be shortcutters view themselves as collective actors in making the city, and not simply making do, then and only then do they become occupiers. Moreover, in their act of occupation, these collective actors make palpable the irony noted earlier that Chicago's public spaces are not public at all. In In fact, from what I've seen, we have no public spaces here. We just have revenue generators. Perhaps this irony helps to explain, at least in part, the local media's attempt to ignore Occupy Chicago movement or subject it alternately to ridicule. Although I must say there was a nice little human interest piece in there done by one of their column writers. It was more about how she was cold while standing out there with them, but it was nice, it was touching. As the lawyer in Melville's masterful tale, Bartleby the Scrivener of Tale of Wall Street, who's confronted by the unfixable and unfathomable suffering of his bewildering employee, the inhabitant of Chicago is reminded by the occupiers of the thing they wish they did not know. I prefer not becomes not only the public refrain, but also the Bartleby-like Occupy movement uses this same refrain to remind Chicagoans their city does not belong to them, but instead to the tourists and to the businesses who, under the euphemism of the public-private partnership, have gradually begun to purchase its ground from under their feet. Having found the weak link in the city's rationale, it is now imperative to decide how that message might best be conveyed. How can we exploit it? By way of a conclusion, I have an immodest proposal for you this afternoon that I hope might spark a fruitful discussion following my remarks. That proposal involves the suggestion that any group of occupiers in Chicago adopt and adapt tactics outlined by Mao Zedong in his struggle with Japan and then later with the nationalist forces of Chiang Kai-shek. What Mao referred to as revolutionary war or a people's war depended on acknowledging the reality of asymmetrical force. Not able to confront power directly, Mao shaped his force into a mosquito that would slowly drain his opponent not only of blood but also of the will to fight. Now let me be clear, I am not advocating in any way, shape, or form that the Occupy movement engage in violence. Rather, I am imagining occupation here as not a static phenomenon, but a rolling series of occupations. Static occupations, such as those occurring across the United States, operate best when they're strength in numbers, and we've seen this in the news. It's much harder to evict several thousand people from a public square than a few hundred. And when you try to do it, it typically involves violence. You get scenes like Oakland, you get scenes like Tahrir Square, and on and on and on. It is much harder to evict several thousand people from a public square than a few hundred. However, in Chicago, where the number of static occupiers has remained fairly small, such tactics not only fail to achieve the desired result, but add to the impression the movement lacks the strength to survive, that it lacks public support and interest. And I've heard that many, many times, not just from people in the city, but from intellectual colleagues of mine from all over the world. A rolling occupation would challenge that perception by allowing small groups of anywhere from 10 to 100 occupiers to appear seemingly at random at different points within the city. One day at LaSalle and Jackson, the next at Daley Plaza, following that the Water Tower, and perhaps even the shopping sanctuaries, God forbid, of Lincoln Park. We wouldn't want to disturb the ladies while they're buying their expensive organic handbags. These rolling occupations need only have two recurring aspects to them. First, they should, whenever possible, target the weak underbelly of the city's power, the outsiders. It's no accident, after all, that Mayor Daley allowed Oprah to tape a show on Michigan Avenue, but would not issue a permit to anti-war protesters to march on the same street. A good middle-class homeowner, and Chicago clearly sees itself in that light, keeps discord off the front lawn. Always show a good face to the neighbors. If you bring dissent to the city's front yard, you not only highlight the fact that the beauties of the city are a gift from those in power to the city's residents, instead of an inheritance, but also draw the undivided attention of City Hall and the currently recumbent Chicago media. I think they've eaten too much deep dish pizza because they've been sleeping now for quite a while. Fully aware that this is the political equivalent of teasing the bears, and we've all been told it's not good to do that when you go to the zoo, it is important to know the right moment to back off with these rolling occupations. Attention provoked, move to another space, but do not stop. And this is the second attribute necessary to make rolling occupations work. Mayor Emanuel must be confronted with the specter of near constant annoyance popping up unpredictably all over the city, a recurring nightmare. Recurring nightmare for Il Duce, Emmanuel I. He will then be forced either to choose bargain or crackdown. Which will it be? Do you sit and speak with those who have a legitimate right to be heard? Or do you let the cameras do the talking as you beat up ordinary people for asking what is their right? Unfortunately, constant motion is inevitable for Occupy Chicago. As I've just showed you in some of these examples, our city's design, as well as the movement's still modest numbers, determine this reality. However, targeted protests rolling from one public space to another will create an effective movement to redefine the collective narrative of the city. Occupation done in a dynamic rather than static way will be Chicago's surest path to reclaiming the right to the city. Thank you all very much for your attention.